Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. Thanks again for coming back for another live episode of Midrats, and also hello to those that are getting us there via the archive. And as a reminder for those that are with us live, if you'd like to join in the conversation, a great way to do that, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll see the chat room. You can roll in there with the usual suspects. And if in the course of the show, if there's an observation you have or maybe a question you would like for Eagle One or myself to go ahead and ask our guests, that's a great place to do it. And if you have to leave halfway through the show or you want to catch up on some previous shows, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now let's get on with the show. My co-host and I, as both consumers and occasional low-rate producers of ideas, opinion, and discussion on the maritime national security arena, we're firm believers that more conversation is better than less, and more ideas are better than fewer. And last year we saw a new group come on the horizon there, from the Center for International Maritime Security, otherwise known as CIMSEC. If you're not already looking at their New Navy blog or up there on Twitter as well, I would highly recommend that you do that. It's a great way to feel another pulse of what's going on in the thought arena for those areas that are interested in maritime in general, national security areas. CIMSEC is a nonprofit think tank, also website, and as a group blog discusser of all the issues that most of the listeners of Midrats are very familiar with. And we've brought on today the perfect person to discuss not just the role in the marketplace of ideas that CIMSEC has, but also in a larger sense, a lot of the issues that those of us are concerned about. And that is Lieutenant Scott Cheney Peters, United States Naval Reserve. He is a surface warfare officer and also a government civilian employee on the OPNAV staff up in D.C. He's the former editor of Surface Warfare magazine, and he served aboard both the USS Fitzgerald, DDG-62, and the USS Oak Hill, LSD-51. He's a graduate of Georgetown University and also the U.S. Naval War College. Scott, welcome to Midrats.
Yeah, thank you for having me here, Sal, and you go on. Definitely happy to be on. I'm going to throw out the standard disclaimer because I know we'll be talking about this as well. But these are my own personal opinions. Don't reflect those illustrious institutions that you mentioned, nor those of my wife. As we are a collective at CIMSEC, sort of like anonymous, but without the masks or any sort of hacking skills. And we're also not anonymous for the most part. I'm just speaking only on my own personal views and not those of the organization in a broader sense.
Absolutely. So we've got all our firewalls in place. And as I mentioned in the intro, you started up last year CIMSEC. What was it that made you decide that you wanted to get CIMSEC running, and what was your initial goal when you went ahead and jumped in the arena?
Sure. So when I started, I didn't really know where it was going to take us or take me. I was working up in OPNAV N96, the Surface Warfare Division over at the Pentagon, and was also finishing up my time on completing my master's through the Naval War College and turning over Surface Warfare magazine. So I kind of wanted to find a way to stay engaged writing on maritime security issues, and thought it would be kind of personally fun and rewarding to see if they could set up a website and just kind of see if it would allow me to interact with some people out there that I thought were pretty interesting, and also provide an avenue for others to kind of have an easy way to get their own voices out there and heard.
As you got started on this, have you reached a conclusion as to what, like, the top five maritime security issues are in play right now?
Oh, top five. That's a good question. I mean, one of the sort of perennial issues is always the, you know, the force structure going forward. What is the right amount of platforms to have for any military? What are the right platforms to have? I guess those would be, that would be kind of one top issue. You know, more of a contemporary issue would be the sort of rise of the drones and how quickly and to what best effect using drones will play in the Navy going forward. I think third would probably be sort of managing information flow. Kind of touched on that coming up as well. And then I'd have to think a little bit harder for a fourth and a fifth.
One of the things that I think is a great opportunity, but I don't know whether it's really blossomed as much as many of us would hope, and I think there's a variety of institutional reasons why, but you know, when you look at traditional publications or even quasi non-traditional publications, I mean, you see a lot of people like the CNO, etc., that are publishing in Foreign Policy, Wall Street Journal, but also you have the normal one of Proceedings and other traditional national security institutions where people go out there and publish. And it seems on occasion that they, with all these senior officers, whether they're bull captains or some, you know, general officer or flag officer publishing, seems to suck a lot of the oxygen out of the air, and along with the frustration that a lot of institutions have had. I know we've talked about it here a few times, and I know USNI is trying to get more junior officers, i.e. 04 or below, engaged in the conversation. And when you look historically, whether you're looking at Mahan or Sims or even Stavridis, they didn't wait until they were senior officers to start publishing, and publishing some articles that, you know, rattled a few of the right cages, so to speak, because that's really where you get your when people reach his positions to really be able to set policy, that you just can't engage in the marketplace of ideas when they're senior. They need to grow, they need to learn how to do it, and really to get some confidence to really be able to stick it out there. And, you know, there you are, a little USNR lieutenant, and so I know a lot of the guys at the SimSec are, you know, kind of that entry-level thought process. What has been your experience trying to get the more junior voice engaged in the conversation, putting some ideas out there, maybe throwing off a spark or two? Do you think that it's easier to do that now because of the lower barriers of entry than it used to do? Or is it more difficult to get people and thinkers to go out there and to be willing to take the slings and arrows in conflict that naturally comes from putting out ideas that don't read like a PAO release?
You know, I do think that it's a little bit easier now than it has been in the past. I know the article that you had linked on your website from Lieutenant Commander Claude Berube kind of touched on this a lot of, you know, some of the senior leadership sort of becoming engaged, as well as one thing that I think we've been blessed with is actually the ability in the U.S. Armed Forces, especially the Navy, is having sort of these clear guidelines on what is allowed with respect to public engagement and social media. And so it's, you know, it's allowed us as active and reserve service members to participate more readily in this sort of exchange of ideas than those in other countries might have had. One of the things I did before coming on to this show was I shot out just a little thing on our Facebook group asking if anybody had any anecdotes or impressions that they wanted to share about SimSec coming on board and writing for it. And one of the contributors, our Polish contributor, wrote, "My first and endearing impression about SimSec is openness. I know only one institution more hierarchical than the military. It is the Catholic Church, no intention to offend anybody. I'm Catholic as well, he says, and goes on. So this is striking for someone from an old socialist country that Navy officers are speaking openly. I'm also impressed by your approach to make SimSec international. So that kind of touches on a couple things. The first is that, you know, we in the military, as I said, in the Navy in particular, have this opportunity that I think a lot of people are realizing. So if they want to get engaged, I think there's not as much reluctance as there may have been even 5 years ago, because I've seen sort of the people go forward and, you know, make examples of themselves in being engaged publicly, you know, as long as they're sticking to the sort of general guidelines of, you know, saying nothing sensitive or classified. And I think it's also, however, one opportunity that hasn't been fully reached with regards to professional military education. I think that there's a good opportunity to sort of tie in, you know, some of these institutions like the Naval War College, Naval Postgraduate School, Naval Academy, where there's a lot of intellectual thought and energy that goes into developing some pretty interesting ideas. But that's one area where I haven't, and it might be my own limited perspective, but I haven't seen as much sort of plugged into the exchange of ideas, both with sort of the experts at the other institutions, and then also with sort of us, you know, amateur professionals trying to, you know, make some changes or bring up some interesting ideas.
One of the people in the B.J. Armstrong, actually, in the chat room has asked a question about whether or not the use of pen names is does it help or hurt? Are we risking not being thought as serious people if we use a pen name? Or is it necessary to use a pen name because of the fear that the sword of Damocles will drop on our head if we get too far out of line?
Well, interesting question. I've actually discussed this with BJ before. I haven't really taken a firm stance one way or the other. I know that for some people, you know, by virtue of the position that they hold, they might not always be able to go out and discuss things openly because it might get their, you know, their boss or somebody else in trouble if they're, you know, it's known that it's coming from them just because of the association with who they are working. But in general, I think that it's helpful to go forward. I guess at this stage, I think it's helpful to go forward with your own name. But I can see that, and I have experienced, you know, people not necessarily taking somebody serious by virtue of their being more junior, being, you know, lower ranked, not having as much complete experience. So, you know, I guess I obviously have taken more of the approach of, you know, not hiding behind a pen name or using one, not necessarily hiding. But for some, I think it can be helpful just because there are still some prejudices out there against sort of the opinions and voices, you know, despite what people say, coming from sort of the more junior ranks. And that's one of the things that we kind of try to employ when we were, you know, developing this group is making sure that it would be easy for people, whether they wanted to remain anonymous or not, but on this more junior side to get engaged in the conversation, to make it easy to know that they could jump into the conversation and put up a piece. And we'd do some initial proofreading, some initial, you know, back and forth of a peer review, but otherwise just let them, you know, have their say and not being from the sort of perspective that somebody that may have a little bit less experience might not know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I've always found that kind of interesting. When I was on active duty, literally there was one person who knew what I actually was, and now that I'm retired, there's a couple of dozen, and, you know, Sal is more or less a marketing thing now. Last night I had dinner with, you know, some of the people that are familiar to people who visit my blog on a regular basis, you know, Byron and also Brian Black. And we also had, you know, you're speaking of junior people, we also had Lucien Gaultier, the YN2 who thinks larger than most 06s that I know. And I always give Lucian a lot of credit. You know, YN2, he's in the process of becoming a CTR, is early on, he engaged in ideas. It started off, and I don't think I'm sharing too much here, but he started a conversation one-on-one on email with a few people who were accessible. And then he started putting forth his ideas, and he was always himself, which was quite brave. And I think he sets a perfect example of the fact that intellectually, I think it's helpful if people don't discriminate on the basis of not just of age, but of rank. And you know, you can go back again to Sims and Mahan and Stavridis, who did this when they were young, amongst others. But there is an ingrained prejudice for that, which is usually by those who never published themselves, is what I have found. And for those that have been in D.C., and I know you know this in spades, Scott, you know, you go and you talk, if you're involved, you have a lobbying effort of one way or another. When you go talk to people, you're talking to staffers, and a lot of these are, on a good day, they're 25, 26. As an institution, for some reason, we don't give much weight to an opinion because it comes from a 31-year-old lieutenant commander who, oh, by the way, has 6 combat tours under his belt, 2 of which are on the ground being shot at. But we defer half of our budget to a bunch of 25-year-olds who are still in the first car that they bought. So I think trying to get that battle and that conversation going is important, but you mentioned integrating with the Naval War College, and we had one of the professors on a few months ago. We've had other people on. We've always bring up this subject with them because having gone to the Naval War College, there are some great ideas. There are some diamonds in the rough there that these papers are written that you really would like to have come out there and be part of the conversation. But a lot of these lieutenants, lieutenant commanders, they literally tell their professors, never publish this or I will be destroyed. I don't want this out here. I don't want this published. And that's a big frustration there. And I always give soon to be replaced former Under Secretary of Work, Bob Work, credit, is the fact that he was always out there in the ideas and a lot of it was retired people like John Patch. He would engage with by name, and he would even visit over at information dissemination. He'd hop into comments at my place. He was engaged in a marketplace of ideas, which I think having somebody like him or even Stavridis or Harvey, who would encourage people to get into the marketplace of ideas and to give a push and shove back and forth without a fear of being squished like a bug, is great. But Bob Work is going back over to CNAS, and Admiral Stavridis is going to go do the Lord's work with our future diplomats, and I know Admiral Harvey's doing some good stuff too. I look at our 3- and 4-star collection right here for somebody that is like that, who is engaged like that, that can increase the comfort level for our junior personnel to engage in the discussion, especially right now where we need some good ideas. I'm missing it. Do you see, from your perspective, a couple of 2, 3, or 4-star admirals that could help create an environment where we can have more of our bright minds that are hiding in the shadows come forward with their ideas and make it better for all of us? I'm having trouble identifying the next Stavridis, Harvey, and Bob Work.
Well, I can say that the office that I'm co-located with, I work at N80, and N81 is actually the physical space in the Pentagon that I work. And I do know that Admiral Fogo has written some pieces up on USMI, and he's been very willing to engage with commenters on his post. So I think that's the only one that I'm directly familiar with as far as having also, coming up in the ranks right now as an admiral that has also been engaged in that capacity.
Let's go back a little bit. You were talking about the, at least 3 of the maritime security issues facing us. So one of them had to do with the force structure and the composition of the force. And I want to take off on that and talk a little bit about the LCS world. Is that an area where there? I mean, here's an idea that came up. Admiral Sobrowski and all these other people said, you know, we need this kind of ship Captain Wayne Hughes. And, should there have been more debate, more open discussion about what we needed for a surface ship? Is that how you view things, that in the marketplace of ideas we could develop better stuff if we had more discussion about it? That would be a great idea, but, you know, here's another thought. Or is that just a endless wheel that would just keep spinning and spinning?
I guess from my perspective, I think it's almost more of the latter of the sort of endless wheel. It's you know, something that I've dealt with as far as I had worked on with I had the pleasure of working with Admiral Sam Perez on the, you know, quote unquote Perez report, and it was it was definitely a very worthwhile and interesting experience. But I'm not really entirely sure, you know, at what stage in developing a ship, when you have to develop the clear requirements for it, as well as what end is it addressing? How is the means and the ways that you're developing, how is that addressing those ends? So, I do think that there was a lot of philosophically interesting aspects that went into the development of LCS, but I do think that it's something above, I guess I'm not smart enough perhaps to really determine the best way of realistically developing a platform that would be, satisfy everybody. I know there's a good article by Robert Holzer, which I'm sure that I think one or both of you commented on, either agreeing or disagreeing with, about the sort of birthing pains of different ship classes in the past, and how there's sort of always a degree of criticism that surrounds how it was or what came about out of it. But how you develop the actual ship, I'm sort of the firm, figuring out what you want it to do, and then what you're trying to accomplish, and then going back from there and figuring out what the best product that you can go forward with. But obviously there's a lot of complicated issues that go into it as far as technological maturity and costs associated with it and all sorts of things. So I'm sure we could talk for hours about that.
One thing that has always kind of chafed me wrong about, and you can use LCS as an example, but there are others, is oftentimes it appears as if the official Navy structures, whether it's active duty flag officers writing articles or statements by public affairs officers of any rank, they start to sound less like customers. The military is the customers of the defense complex, the Lockheeds, the Boeings, the General Dynamics, etc. They sound less like customers and more like part of the industrial complex. Like, that's not the Navy spokesman, that is the spokesman for Northrop Grumman, just to use a name out there. Whereas you can look back within living memory and you had the occasions of somebody like, Vice Admiral Tom Connolly, who used the, there's not enough, I think it was thrust in all of Christendom to make this a fighter, speaking of the F-111, that there's not enough of an attitude that we're a customer, vice a co-defender of programs in front of Congress. Is there an atmosphere in D.C. where the military could perhaps be a little more of a rough customer in that respect, or is the decision such that if we start to act that way, we play into the hands of those that don't just want to cut certain parts of the defense budget, but want to cut anything in DOD, and we'll wind up getting no new programs and nothing at all? And do you think that's part of the matrix and why we seem to defend everything as if we work for that company? Or is there something else that drives that desire to defend, vice the desire to be an active and engaged and a little bit of a demanding customer?
Very, very good question. I think there's a little bit of both. There's, obviously the desire to come out with the best product that you can get. There's some, I think, reticence once something's been selected, probably to, publicly attack it for fear of any sort of, political highlighting of that program as, a potential place to find some cost savings. I do think that there, at least from my own experience, I've seen a lot of, attempts to, at least in the current environment, really try to get the most bang for the buck from the, the defense industry. And I think what more seems to happen is that it's a worry that, needing to make sure that they have the sort of the defense industrial base available to support the competition that they would like to see happen for the next products that come out. But it's definitely an interesting place to see it develop. But I do think that it's, at least publicly, there's probably, that's why there's that defense, is because they don't want to have something necessarily cut. But at the same time, I think there's more of that sort of debate, I guess, internal, and more of the drive to try to find the, to improve the product internally, which I know, having been a, somebody that's involved in, more public debate, can be frustrating at times. But I do think that that's something that the, sort of the public debate and exchange of ideas helps with, is, a lot of these articles that are written from the, the outsiders looking in, or those with at least a little bit of information looking in, it does kind of feed into some of the discussions or some of the readings that the decision makers look into. So I have seen a lot of your pieces, my pieces, other people's pieces on some of these, weekly reading lists. So the information is at least getting to some of the decision makers, and, whether or not that is where the decisions are made and based off of, it's probably not solely that. There's a lot of in-house analysis that goes on, but it does play a part in sort of driving up new ideas and thinking about the ways that military can get the best bang for its buck.
Well, speaking of bang for the buck, I mean, one of the things you mentioned earlier too, and I've seen it in your blog stuff, is we've got all these new technologies coming down the pike, the USVs, UUVs, UAVs, Lord knows what else. How should we be discussing that in terms of, should we be discussing that in tactics and as part of our strategic focus? Where do you think our discussion ought to be headed on use, proper use, and development of those tools?
No, that's a great question, too. As far as what we as naval thinkers should be concentrating on, I certainly think it's a mix, both as far as, figuring out what are some of the better platforms that are out there. And that's one thing that, that we've been able to partner with some other sites. And that's one thing that we at SimSec enjoy doing, is, bringing in the sort of international perspectives by being able to, bring in some writers from these other sites that are, the same sort of mission set of trying to figure out the best way to tackle some of these maritime security problems, and giving them a little bit more exposure here in the U.S., as well as allowing some of our writers a little bit more exposure through their sites. But I think there's a lot of good thinking that's going on as far as figuring out both what platforms might be the best to use, as well as how to best integrate those in the, upending our sort of naval warfare strategies. That is going to be a very interesting facet to follow, is, seeing what sort of new, not only technologies are developed, but how they're used. And that's something that I think people don't necessarily need to have a fully, full expert understanding of the technology to be able to understand, at least some sort of innovative ways that they could potentially be used. But once they are more fully understood, figuring out how to integrate them with both new ways of fighting as well as our current ways of fighting, one thing that drones especially bring up is kind of the information flow that has kind of overwhelmed a lot of human operators in this past decade or so. There's a lot of data that sifts through that's been coming off of these drones, and I'm certainly not the first person to bring this up. We've done a better job of generating information, both human-produced and from these IR sensors or these ISR sensors, and sharing it. And it's very hard for people to manually sift through all of this new information, and this has led to the development of technological tools to help alert operators to what's important in that sort of data pile. And I think it's going to be one of the more important things to get right going forward, and it's going to be a persistent requirement, is looking for ways to simply and cheaply make sure that that important information gets the operator's attention, which is obviously easier said than done, but I only have to say it and not actually do it. In a similar vein, managing the information flow and relationship between the producers and consumers of the information is going to be important. And that's whether we're talking about sort of the mundane reports that need to go up through chains of command or in-house shipboard or unit record keeping. Anyone who's been out in the fleet lately can tell you that there's a lot of requirements that are at best duplicative in nature or at worst seemingly of little value. And this creates a large, potentially unnecessary admin burden on our frontline warfighters. So this is another important persistent requirement, and that's kind of evaluating whether some of the burden should be shifted from the consumers of data, say DESRON staff, if they can get the data they seek, say that of a status of a CAS rep in one of the other formats they might already be receiving or have access to, instead of asking for their own special report to sort of reduce the burden on themselves. Likewise, if evaluating the efficacy of tools that can help automate the process of admin or record keeping. And I know there's a lot of efforts that have gone on and are ongoing, but it's really looking at the reporting requirements themselves and determining whether they're worth the extra workload burden on sort of our warfighters. And I guess also the technological tools that are developed to try and help these operators sift through all this data or reduce the reporting burden, they also have to be evaluated from the perspective of what vulnerabilities it might create, especially on the cyber side. And there's an interesting report last week on Bloomberg that talked about the hacking of the defense firm Kinetic and how the hackers appeared particularly interested in access to an Army helicopter condition-based maintenance system. And so we have kind of this clear example of a system designed to reduce that burden on the maintainer, but potentially compromising the mission, dependent on whether the hackers can actually read the data that they have access to. But this is sort of brings to light that a determination needs to be made when we develop these systems or decide to implement them, whether it's worth the potential for an adversary to have access to that system.
In building off that point, over in the chat room, Chris Raleigh brought up a good point that was actually part of the conversation that I had with a great group of folks earlier this week in D.C., and I think it's a problem that we all can suffer on. We like to talk a lot about programs and how do we get the money for this program when we get this program, and it's going to eventually displace water and make a shadow on a ramp. But especially when you look at the not just the bandwidth requirements of what it would take with all these unmanned systems, but also what's in that bandwidth and what are you going to do with it and what's your intellectual capital to be able to break out from data the information that you need, is there's not really much of a conversation about, okay, now you have this wonderful tool. Now, how are you going to operate it? I think you see a lot of that with the UCAV. It's like, okay, how are you actually going to make this reusable TLAM function? And is that because a lot of this conversation is taking place behind the cipher door, or is part of the problem the fact that we focus too much on the program and the process and just hope that somebody in the fleet will find some practical, tactical application to it?
Yeah, no, I'm sure the conversation is going on. I do know that, you know, there is a lot of sort of effort and emphasis on trying to make sure that, you know, we're not developing just cool toys as opposed to trying to match an actual requirement that we've sort of analyzed and determined as a, you know, a validated requirement going into the whole, you know, JSIDs and, you know, urgent needs process. That's obviously a, the sort of purpose of those processes. I don't know that those are always, you know, followed in the strictest sense whenever something comes along that looks really neat and interesting. You know, there is a lot of effort that happens that, you know, some people are fighting the good fight and trying to make sure that, you know, just because something looks amazing doesn't necessarily mean that it's what is best to fund or to go forward and develop. So that is some, you know, a healthy discussion that goes on. I'm not sure who's necessarily winning that discussion in the military, but I do know that discussion is going on. There are a lot of interesting requirements that are out there, or a lot of things that people, you know, would like to see developed, and that's actually something that, you know, I could say that I myself am probably guilty of, is, you know, highlighting the things that are kind of neat and new, not necessarily how best to use what we have existing or cheaply. And that's something that, you know, is something that, again, going back to what naval thinkers should be thinking about, is, you know, trying to figure out not necessarily just what could be the most potentially devastating, you know, spectacular fireworks that we could develop, but also how to do it very cheaply using our existing tools, perhaps.
So you just set me off on a line of thought that I want to chase down a little bit. You know, we set up a lot of programs these days that seem to create a single point of failure possibility. So let's say that we design a fleet around the F-35. You know, we think we're got all these great capabilities, but if that aircraft fails to deliver the way we hope it will, where's the other alternative? Where's plan B? Isn't that kind of the debate we ought to be having on some of these issues? If you know, where the great Navy thinkers ought to be going, you know, if this doesn't work, what is plan B?
Oh, certainly. I would certainly say that, you know, developing alternatives or thinking about those would definitely be a worthwhile endeavor. So hopefully we'll maybe see some of these sort of alternatives crop up. Actually, one of our members had suggested we do a week of analysis focused on alternatives to the F-35, and we've done some of these weeks in the past. We've focused on things like 3D printing, seasteading, an International Maritime Satire Week, which was just kind of an homage to The Onion, since Duffelblog was kind of missing out on a lot of maritime material at the time, the Maritime Futures Project, and most recently a week on alternatives to the Flight 3 DDG. So these are some weeks where we'll set a topic out and have one particular, or invite all of our participants and then whoever else wants to partake, sort of focus their analytical or intellectual energies on a particular problem. And that's one that we've thought about having go forward in our next week. But we are an all-volunteer organization, so we don't always, because I'm sure you guys are in a similar boat, don't always have the, you know, the full time and attention we'd like to put into some of these endeavors, but that is definitely something that we've looked at doing in our, and will probably be our next analysis week.
Yeah, it's hard enough to control one of your own hobbies, much less coordinate everybody else's hobbies too. Early on, you mentioned, you know, a lot of your international partners, you know, Poles. I also see where, you know, you keep a finger on the pulse of some of your counterparts in the UK, France, Germany, Canada, and especially the Europeans. We've only really started to pick our belly button about the budget challenges that we're going to be facing here within the last couple of years, while in Europe they're well into a half decade plus of some pretty austere impacts on their defense budgets. Just curious, one general question, one specific, when you look at some of the international counterparts to what you and your band of merry men and women are doing over there at SIMSEC, do you think there's a difference on how some of your foreign counterparts discuss issues, different priorities? And have you seen anything on how they've reacted and adjusted to financial challenges and fleet reductions that might be a good benchmark for those in the U.S. who are just starting to think in that same vein?
Yeah, and that's another excellent question. I know a lot of the sort of international partners definitely do come in with a different mindset, especially the, I guess, the non-European ones. We've been able to get some Australians, which have certainly had a nice, interesting outlook on the sort of Asian perspective and what's going on in their sort of neck of the world. So I've definitely enjoyed, you know, seeing what are sort of the top concerns for some of our, you know, friends overseas. As far as, you know, what sort of lessons we can learn from them, you know, like you said, that they have gone through, you know, especially in a lot of other countries, you know, they haven't necessarily had the, you know, build up in military spending that we've gone through in the past decade or so, even if it hadn't been primarily focused on our naval spending. But a lot of them have gone through, as you mentioned, sort of a reduction in spending regardless, although some in Asia and the South Pacific are actually increasing their military spending. So there is not always a path that we're going to be following, especially also since a lot of them have different sort of outlooks on what the potential threats are. I think we are probably one, if not the only one that we see sort of the rise of China in a much different context than our European partners do, but not necessarily a different context than our Asian partners do. I know they're obviously a lot more concerned, especially those with direct potential maritime conflicts or boundary disputes in, you know, the Spratlys and the Parcells and the Senkakus and all throughout the Nine Dash Line region. As far as the development of programs, you know, they've had a lot of interesting ideas. I know I've seen a lot of discussion of developing more helicopter-based amphibious ships, or a lot of projection of power based off of those types of helicopter carriers, or, you know, shorter, you know, the V-stall type of carriers, as well as, you know, development of amphibious landing craft. One of the things that we've seen, I guess, from the ones that have reduced spending, one of the efforts that some countries have made is trying to figure out how to share their, you know, spending burdens with their partners. Like the UK and the French have, you know, looked at, you know, sharing or rotational carrier programs, but it always comes back to sort of the question of when push comes to shove, will you be there? Can I count on you when I have a national objective that I need to accomplish that you might not see in the same light? And so that's something that, you know, we can certainly take as a lesson, is that, you know, our national interest will never be perfectly aligned with another nation's. So it's certainly good, and there's certainly opportunities to partner with other nations and, you know, mutual defense arrangements. But as far as the actual sharing of platforms themselves might be a little bit trickier of a thing to accomplish, and probably not something that I would recommend pursuing as an effort.
Well, on the other hand, we've managed to share the Aegis technology with a number of countries, and it, your piece on the DDG Flight 3s prompted me to go look at the Japanese helicopter destroyer again, because I noticed a number of people in there in your piece talked about the value of the MH-60s to the fleet, and I was, you know, I'm not sure we shouldn't be looking at a platform like that too, although I guess in theory we could use some of our amphibs to accomplish that if they're not busy doing something else.
Oh, sure, and I didn't mean to say not sharing necessarily the technology or, you know, arms sales, et cetera. I meant the actual physical rotational sharing of platforms for the armed forces.
Well, kind of on a personal basis, because you're, you know, not only are you a naval reservist, but you're also wearing a civilian outfit you go over to OpNav as well. You work at OpNav. What type of feedback do you get from your counterparts at OpNav? And do you get any feedback, or do they just not know? They don't care, or do you get people come by and bring up topics that may have shown up over at SimSec?
It's kind of a good mix. Some are blissfully unaware, which is nice. You know, I'm not really doing this to seek a lot of attention or anything. I know my immediate coworkers kind of more than anything sort of, you know, just kind of kid me over the participation that I have in SimSec. But then I do have some others that, you know, are in 80 and 81 and who, you know, I've been able to talk to about some of the ideas that have come up. And, you know, like I mentioned, those weekly reads, you know, I've seen those, some articles on some of those weekly reads. So it's nice, again, to know that, you know, some of the ideas are out there, at least if people want to take a look, and that some people actually are reading them. So you do get some good feedback from that. But yeah, obviously it's try to keep the work and this a little bit separate. So there are, you know, certainly things that I see by virtue of my position that I think, you know, are incredibly interesting, but have to sort of steer away from them. So I occasionally find myself, you know, driving more towards topics that I know less, at least from my work experience, than I would otherwise.
Well, speaking of your work experience, since you were, I gather, a former editor of Surface Warfare magazine, how much did that experience help you with where you currently are and with your SimSec and the other part of your non-civilian work world?
Well, it certainly helped me, I guess, keep my writing and editing aspect up, because a lot of the skills directly translated into, you know, what I would be doing as far as with SimSec, both reaching out if I saw something that, you know, piqued my interest and engaging with somebody either out in the fleet or out in, you know, just the maritime world and asking if A, they'd either like to write something or would like to, you know, get involved with our organization. So the sort of networking aspect, which is something that I very much enjoyed being able to do with this organization, and I think a lot of other people involved with the organization have been able to enjoy. But also the editing and writing skills that, you know, were involved with editing the magazine has certainly directly translated into what I've been doing with SimSec, and just, you know, trying to make sure at least we have some minimum level of, editorial standards when we put something up. Just find that it's, you know, people give it how much weight does somebody or value does somebody give to an idea. Unfortunately, there is the reality that there's a little bit more value that's placed on something that looks a little bit more polished. So we try to just help give people that little bit of polish when it goes up.
Yeah, sometimes I have to remind... For those that saw the earlier versions of the show advertisements, yes, I did spell two things wrong because I have fat fingers. It always helps to have it, an editor handy. Unfortunately, my listeners and readers are my editors, so I get hazed on a regular basis because I have a learning disability. I'll blame it on that. Because you're in D.C. and you know,
an inability to spell was a learning disability.
Oh, shut up. Being stupid is a disability. You keep forgetting that. I blame it on having large hands. Insert joke here. You kind of advertise SimSec as a think tank website, group focused blog. I wanted to back up a bit because you're in D.C. and especially being a Georgetown man as you are, you're pretty soaked in the fact that in D.C., really in any major topic area, but especially in national security, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting the think tank. And there are different flavors of think tanks. There are, you know, the free form, free price of admission think tanks, and, you know, small think tanks. There are institutional think tanks. There are the hired gun think tanks, i.e. they'll write about whoever paid them the latest type of thing. From your view there in D.C., for those outside of D.C., when they see think tank, what are the different major flavors of think tanks? If you don't want to apply names to them, I understand, that's fine. But what are some of the things people need to look at if you're trying to find out whether this think tank report is bought for, paid for, comes from a certain skew, or might just be an objective opinion from the author himself?
Well, I think you certainly classified or came up with a good sort of means of classification for the different type of think tanks. We're obviously more of the free-form variety, nonprofit. The only revenue we have is, nothing. We just got our paper signed this weekend, actually, to become an official 501c3, so that's exciting, and we'll have a board election here soon. And my wife actually, gave me a hard time when we first came up with our name because, we called ourselves a center, and she said we couldn't do that since we don't have an actual physical presence or building anywhere. But as far as the what to look for, I would say, it really just kind of comes down to, you're being familiar with the actual think tank itself and sort of, understanding sort of the ecosystem of think tanks and which ones by their reputation are known to be, what means of the political spectrum or try to be, independent, regardless of what they say on their, sort of mission statements. I'm not really sure. I'm sure there are, ways to legally find out what the, their legal status and what rules they need to abide by to, make certain claims, but I'm not particularly aware of them. I think it's just more of a, becoming familiar with a particular think tank and knowing its, both its leanings, who it takes money from, as well as, it very well might not at all, and it might be an honest, independent think tank. But generally, a lot of them, like you said, are kind of more of the, they need to get their funding from somewhere. So there are a lot of good ones that get their funding from, private donations. But I just go back to knowing what the think tank is intimately itself. And, if there's one that comes up that you have no, prior knowledge of, try to do the research and find out what you can about it. And if it's very hard to discern, then that might not be a good sign.
Well, do you, like the rest of us in the who work in this strange world, find yourself turning down an endless stream of invitations to attend functions discussing maritime security and the importance of that issue to the United States?
Well, I'm probably not as popular as you two, so I'm not sure if I get an endless stream. I get, just a variety of invitations to attend as certainly not a participant on any sort of panel or anything, but just to come and, see what their discussion is about, which I try to go to a lot because I usually find a lot of them very, very interesting and, again, sort of offering those others' perspectives. But, yes, before I go, I certainly try to find out, what I can about the organization and if they're serving free food. That is definitely one of my criteria for whether I will, attend or not.
Free food in an open bar, that's always a good thing. Another thing is you're not a one-person show. You've got a variety of members, a variety of writers that come in there. What type of selection process do you have? Do you go out and you see somebody who you know or you hear of or is recommended to you that you try to bring onto the fold? Or do you have people come to you with ideas, a pull vice a push? How do you get your writers, evaluate your writers, and do you hope that people will produce on a regular basis, or do you take one off?
Well, it's certainly a mix of both. I mean, we'll see people out there that we think are very interesting, or I'll just run into somebody that, sounds like they might provide a good new perspective or be interested in participating, and then offer them the opportunity, to let them know about the site. And if they'd like to participate, great. If not, that's, our loss. But we also get the push aspect of we'll have, anybody can go to our website and, submit a membership application. And it's, to be honest, it's not particularly stringent other than determining that they are in fact a real person, what their sort of background is, and then letting them know what sort of opportunities we provide as far as being a member and working with them if they do want to participate as far as the writing goes. You know, we'll take either one-off sort of things or more, you know, regular contributors, which I certainly prefer regular contributors over just one-off pieces as far as having a steady output, you know, and more indication of somebody that wants to, you know, maintain an involvement. But, you know, I'm just as happy to get somebody who has, you know, one particular issue or idea or, you know, diamond in the rough, as you mentioned before, that they'd like to get put out there, and just as happy to get that, you know, sort of idea, you know, polished up a little bit and put out. But for the first writing, we'll work with them a little bit more closely to make sure that, you know, that they're comfortable working with the sort of WordPress format that we use on the site.
Does being as a retired reserve officer myself, does being a reservist cause you any particular issues with the folks you're working with or the people you're talking to, or do people even know unless you specifically tell them?
Yeah, I'm not actually familiar if anybody in my reserve unit knows that I do this. I've talked to one or two about that seem like they might be interested in it, but beyond that, I'm not sure that anybody there really knows. And you know, the reserve side, as I'm sure you know, is, you know, a lot more relaxed, even further with sort of the openness that the era of openness we're kind of in with, you know, the regulations that allow us to do this sort of, you know, public engagement and debate. You know, it's even more so with on the reserve side. But I did get a proceedings piece published recently that I think my reserve unit then put out to everybody there. So they're aware of that, at least, that I, you know, have that sort of inclination, but I'm not sure if they know that I'm, you know, the dirty blogger, as it were.
Yeah, sometimes I think we overestimate how many people actually give a damn. There's a pretty big pretty big I don't care factor floating around out there. It's my show. I can cuss on occasion if I want to. I always have to be careful with this because I can be a little self-referential in the fact that I'm concerned about Navy and Marine Corps maritime issues, that's what I read. But I do know, you know, you have some Marine Corps land-focused articles there over at SimSec, but the M gives it away. It's maritime. When you're looking at ground combat, I think it's fair, though they wander all over the place, you can kind of put inside that circle in their Venn diagram, Small Wars Journal, the Long War Journal. But one thing that I really have found over the years, whether it's the, you know, Garden Variety blog or the Spit Polished think tank, is the Air Force. The Air Force playing into the conversation. Looking at the land forces, mostly Army, and then in the Air Force, do you see where the U.S. or perhaps there's an international site that you have the land or the Air Force side of the national security equation that are doing this intellectual churn in a little more free-form way, kind of like what we seem to try to do on the maritime side? I just personally don't see it as much. I don't know if that's personality, institutional, or is it a self-referential problem on my part.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know I haven't personally either seen something for the Air Force of the same sort of rigor that the other services have, and that could just be my own, you know, lack of having stumbled across it, because that's not something that, you know, I'm obviously as focused on, but it could be out there. I just don't know, other than maybe the sort of satirical look that Duffel Blog gives the Air Force on occasion.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The Car Talk guys say you've wasted a perfectly good hour talking to us. What are we looking for from you in the next few weeks? And remind everybody again where they can find your SimSec stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So our website is simsec.org. That is spelled C-I-M-S-E-C. Not to hone in on the spelling error that I did perhaps see earlier, but we're looking forward to next week. We're actually we have these monthly meetups, and that also provides another good opportunity of, you know, meeting and discussing ideas of you know, maritime nature. Our next one for the D.C. area is going to be happening over in Annapolis at the Galway Bar and Pub and Restaurants from 1 to 5 next Saturday, the 15th. And as I mentioned, we are just now forming our nonprofit, so we're going to be having our second round of board elections coming up. If anybody is interested, as we said, this is a completely volunteer organization, so we rely on the time and effort of people who make no money, like myself, for their work in pulling this off. So if you're interested in all, you know, check out the website, and you know, especially if you're interested in potentially running for a board position, we'd love to have you with us.
Well, Scott, thanks a lot for coming on this afternoon. I think you just identified a comeback to your wife. Actually, you do have a center. It's just in a pub. So you have a brick-and-mortar location. There you go. You're set now. You're complete. But thanks a lot. I appreciate everybody for coming on board. And do, if you haven't already, do go over to simsec.org. Give Scott and his band of players a read. And it's good to have you guys on board and part of the conversation. I think we're all going to have plenty of things to write and pontificate about over the next few years, Scott.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Scott. Really enjoyed it.
And thank you, everybody. And we're going to have a Father's Day best of next week. So make sure and keep an eye out. We'll pick out one of our better shows for you. And until then, we'll talk to you again on Midrats. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.